hello everyone, welcome to the Fire These Times. My name is Daniel Voskobojnik and I will be your host today. We have the immense privilege, the honor to be joined today by Professor Abdullahi Ahmed Naim. Professor Naim is Charles Howard Candler Professor of Law, Emory Law, Associated Professor in the Emory College of Arts and Sciences, and Senior Fellow of the Center for the Study of Law and Religion of Emory University. He is an internationally recognized scholar of Islam and human rights in cross-cultural perspectives, teaching multiple courses over the years in international law, comparative law, human rights, and Islamic law. His previous books and works include Decolonizing Human Rights, Muslims and Global Justice, and Islam and the Secular State, Negotiating the Future of Sharia, among many others. Today, we'll be talking about many topics, but before we begin, in many traditions, it's almost a disoffense for a younger person to introduce an elder. I don't feel this is a formal introduction, so I don't feel I have the mouth to introduce the elder we'll be speaking with today. I'd love to ask you, Abdullahi, to introduce yourself to the audience. How are you introducing yourself these days?
Yes. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. I'm from Sudan, and usually that's how I start introducing myself. And once from Sudan, always from Sudan. Even if you happen to live somewhere else, as I have been in exile for decades now. Unfortunately, the reasons I had to leave Sudan are still the reasons for the conflict, current conflict in Sudan. But I believe very much in being a global citizen, not just simply a Sudanese or an African or a Muslim. All of these are true for me, but I am everything else that other people are. I'm a father, I'm a grandfather, I'm a student, a scholar, but also an activist, and I take very strong pride in that, in my being an activist. I wish that I never lose the gift of being an activist, and also the feeling, the conviction, and the fire in the belly that makes us act, because that's the only way we can change the world. As a Muslim, I believe that God is in command, and I think Jews have similar convictions. Actually, in my own work recently, I have discovered that, not that recently, but I have discovered that Muslims and Jews have much, much more in common than we would tend to think of in terms of current relations and problems. But there's a deep commitment to certain values, a deep understanding of the value of knowledge and the conviction and the drive of knowledge in our lives. I was born in a village on the Nile, about 200 kilometers north of Khartoum. So Khartoum is the point where the blue and the white Nile meet. 100 miles further, you will come to my village. It is right on the Nile. And very much the consciousness of the river and the desert was really very deep and profound in my own upbringing and early life, because the Nile was a source of life. It was life itself. And yet it was so precariously flowing through a desert, which is one of the harshest deserts in the world we have. And therefore, the contrast between the green and the life-giving Nile and forbidding and harsh desert was a combination that I negotiated through my early life. I was born in the village, but my father worked in the cities, in the towns at that time, in the 1940s and 50s. So I moved with him in a couple of places. Adbara, which is a city north of Khartoum, and north of my village too, where the railway works at the time where we're headquartered. Adbara is right at the point where the river Adbara, which comes from the Ethiopian mountains, flows into the Nile. And that's where the name comes from, the river name, Adbara. So that's my main growing up experience, where I went to school, elementary and secondary school, and then I moved to Omdurman for my high secondary school, and then the University of Khartoum in Khartoum, Sudan. So the experience of growing up in the village, but living mostly in the towns, coming to the village every summer for the 3 months. And from there, I think much of the tensions and conflicts, as well as saving grace of the ability to negotiate and mediate, have come from. So the contrast is really deep rooted in my own consciousness and upbringing. And the environment in which I grew also reflected that. I think that are what I would say about my upbringing so far, unless there is a specific question that you want to pursue. Otherwise, we hope that more will come up as we speak.
Beautiful. That's such a beautiful answer. And thank you for bringing... We're going to talk about mediation quite a bit in the interview. But linking that to the ecologies that you grew up in, seeing these contrasts and the need for mediation is particularly poignant. I'm curious on... This might be a difficult question to remember, but I've heard in different interviews you speak about this kind of this interest and commitment to justice as being something that's in your earliest memories. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about where this comes from. I know you've spoken beautifully also about the impact of your mother and many of the lessons you brought from your parents, but how do you trace the genealogy of your own path of justice? Where does that come from and where does that begin?
Justice is a core value for me, and it is a very selfish commitment to justice, because I feel that I very much, one of the driving forces and impulses in my thinking and life is the golden rule, the idea that do unto others, which I think is universal. In fact, to me, I have written about this early on, that to me it is the foundation of human rights, the golden rule. And as the Jewish scholar said, that everything is in the golden rule, the rest is commentary, I think. You will be familiar with that quote, which is profound too. And everywhere, to every culture, this is a core value. But also it is a very demanding value. And often we tend to, I would say, cheat in a way, because we claim the commitment to the value, but we don't live it. And that's why we'll talk about him more as we go on. Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, the teacher I joined in his movement. He was an engineer by profession, but he was a Sufi and a Muslim scholar and master of the field and of everything else, to my knowledge and understanding. So. To me, the what Ustaz Mahmoud drives the value of live your values, that it is never good enough to preach without living the values. And to him, the idea of unity of thought, speech, and action, that we must think freely and we must speak truthfully to our understanding and thoughts, and we must live the values in our actions and our daily lives. So Ustaz Mahmoud, Muhammad Taha, but my father and mother, especially my mother, I think, in the sense that a child is closest to the mother, and that's where we get most of our values. And especially in our cultures where the father is absent most of the time and not very closely intimate with children. In our culture, it's rare that parents, the father in particular, would show intimacy or affection. Although they do feel it, but the culture is supposed to be austere and removed somewhat. So my mother was the core anchor of our family. I am the oldest of 8 children. Actually, our mother gave birth to 11 children, but 3 of them died in infancy. So... And I was the eldest of all the children. So it was a large household. And because, although our means were very limited, but my father of his generation had to keep his house open to other children to come. Because when we lived in the town, people come for medical treatment, young people come for education, and they stay with us. So we always had this extended family. and that sense of solidarity and understanding the conditions and the reasons people have for moving away from their familiar environment and so on were very early in my own childhood. So it, in terms of influences, I will say Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, but my father and mother had very early and profound influence in my own values and so on. What I emphasize about Ustaz Mahmoud is this notion of living your values. So much that is wrong in the world, so much injustice, so much violence, so much destructive stupidity in all societies come from this notion that the sense of privilege, that we are somewhat exceptional, we are the elite, we are the chosen people, or God's choice and so on. Muslims have it as well as, of course, as we know, Jews also have it and others. But now we have secular Western so-called liberal capitalists who also think that they are privileged and that they are somewhat entitled to squander the wealth and the resources of the world because they are the chosen people or the privileged people. I mentioned earlier fire in the belly. The anger I feel at and the frustration I feel at, how can people be so selfish and narrow-minded into think that they are exceptional? There are no exceptional people or country or society. If anything, some exceptional so-called those who think they are exceptional are in fact exceptionally unexceptional. They are so much wasteful, arrogant, destructive, and I don't like to mention names at this point, but time may come when I, or the occasion may come when I mention, I'll be more specific about this. But I think that is it. Therefore, for me, the key for global coexistence and for any future for humanity to materialize is injustice. Without justice, there is no possibility of almost anything that is of significance and value. And it is such, because it's a universal value, it is so easy to present issues in those terms. I think if any of us would just reflect for a minute, we will see that, in fact, yes, justice is the anchor to our coexistence, and it is. But it requires, and because of that, it requires constant nourishing, nurturing and nourishing and development and advancement. We can never take it for granted, and we will lose it by the very act of taking it for granted. And also, I think, if I may, not to take on too much time, but the point also is that the impulse to which is part of our arrogance and exceptionalism, is to think that we fail to see, we have these blind spots, moral blind spots, that there is such glaring injustice in some of the things that we do, and fundamentally in humanity, and yet we fail to see it. And in fact, the skill to hide the problems, even from our own side, but in plain view for everybody else, is one of the challenges that I think I find myself drawn to raise and to take on.
Mm. Wow. So many things so many threads to pull on. I want to bring you back a tiny little bit to your first encounter with Ustad Mahmoud Taha. So from hearing some of your interviews and looking back at your biography, I know that your teacher at intermediate school or high school, I don't know what it was called in Sudan at the time, nicknamed you Socrates, I think, for all the questions you would ask. Yes. And you talk about arriving, I think in Islam and the secular state, you talk about that a lot of your later work is kind of the continuation of many of the questions you had when you were very, very young. Yes. And so I'm curious if you can, for the audience who may not be familiar with the context of Sudan and the 60s, of course, as you arrive to the University of Khartoum, what are the questions that you're carrying with you, the contradictions, the paradoxes you're struggling with? And I know you describe your encounter with Ustad Mahmoud Taha as this kind of moment of kind of almost like of tranquility or of things coming together. So I'm wondering if you could paint a picture for the audience, what's happening in Sudan at the time, what does Ustad Mahmoud Taha mean in that moment, and what happened with you in that moment that it compelled you to become who you are today?
Yes, good. So, thank you. The notion of justice actually is crucial to that too. Because growing up in Atbara and coming to the village for the summers and also going to school, the tension I felt about justice in relation to Sharia and Islam and human rights, what I later on came to understand and to speak of as human rights. Because in the 50s, the notion of human rights for a child growing up in northern Sudan was not really that's familiar. I remember that because I used to go to, when I came to the University of Khartoum from Atbara, I used to go to Atbara where my parents were still living with my siblings for the summers. But our summers were really wasted in very silly activities. I mean, maybe the equivalent of video games these days. At least we'll go to the library in the town, but we see the library is just the drop point or our joint sort of rendezvous. But mainly we sit outside and we play cards and we waste time. Or at least we thought that was living up what life is like. I remember one time that when, of course, cinema was a crucial part of our summers, and there were three cinema theaters in the city or the town of Atbara. And so I would check at that time, of course, very limited communication. So we'll have to go to the center of the town where there is boards that explain where the movies are, which movies are playing around in the three cinemas. And I remember I was looking and I couldn't see anything worth seeing. And I was frustrated that what can I do if there is no movie to see? And a friend of mine who was from same intermediate school came by and he said, I was telling him, Atayb, there is no movie to see. What can one do? And he said, why don't you come with me to this lecture by Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha? And I had heard the name and I heard of him as an almost legendary Muslim intellectual and nationalist activist at the time, but I never heard him or read him as such. So I said, okay, since there is no good movie to see, I will come with you to the lecture. And that lecture transformed my life forever. About an hour and a half of his presentation and the discussion that followed, and I could never walk away. I remain enchanted and totally mesmerized, because Ustaz Mahmoud was not only speaking truth and common sense and compassionate humanity, but he was not talking to me, but talking for me. That whatever he was saying, immediately I felt that, oh yes, that's how I feel. So that's how it started. And that was in 1968, I think, in the summer of 1968, when I was in Atbara. And when I went back to the University of Khartoum, I continued to go to Taha's seminars and lectures around town, and gradually became part of the movement. The movement really was not a political party, was not something that is formally organized. There is no even record of membership, and just people come and as they feel the benefit of the experience, and they go away or stay away when they don't feel it. Spontaneity and honesty of conviction and freedom were the values that Taha lived by. So it is that kept me going into. And until I went on to study graduate school in Britain and then to go back to teach in Sudan for 10 years. And then I had to leave Sudan by the mid-80s. And throughout, the same fundamental tension between Sharia and human rights remained driving my experiences. bigger negative and positive. So I felt drawn to Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha's ideas because they resolved that tension in my own experience. He presented me almost like, you know, sometimes I say this, that his words were like water on the fire in my heart and soul. That he was putting out the fire. He was resolving the tensions. So I could never walk away. But as I continued to teach and to live abroad and in Sudan, and then had to leave again, especially when Ustaz Mahmoud himself was subjected to the ultimate injustice of being convicted and executed publicly for apostasy. The only Muslim I know in my life, if Ustaz Mahmoud was not a Muslim, there is no Muslim in the entire human population. Sorry to be so strong about this. And the irony is that a man of that caliber and that lifestyle and that generosity and courage and wisdom and insight to be put into a show trial for apostasy and executed publicly in January of 1985 was unbearable. So I had to leave Sudan. I left by April 84. And I have ever since lived outside. Now, recently, I have been able to go back a couple of times to Sudan. And maybe it was ironic, but also poignant, that Ustaz Mahmoud, who ultimately to me presented the mediation of all tension and conflict about my culture, about my values, about my religion, is the one who is to pay his life as a price for his courage and conviction. But so he remains my role model. Everything I do is shaped and influenced and anchored in Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas and so on. So that is the extent of his influence on my life.
Thank you so much for sharing. And today we carry on his memory through your work and through hopefully some of the water that you'll be bringing to tame some of the fires or resolve some of the tensions. I want to bring us to, I think, a very beautiful, I don't know if beautiful, but a very clear idea that you bring. Something that I appreciate about your work is that you're able to work, and I think this comes from the ground in spirituality and in coherence, that you talk on so many different scales, but always bring it back to the human relationship at the end of the day. And yes. I'd love for you to talk a little bit in your work. You've spoken about the imperialist impulse, or the impulse towards imperialism, almost at the root of a lot of injustice, and yes. How this builds up from an interaction, it could be between me and you, to the largest institutions. And I think often, you know, with an activist, you can often get in these conversations that are so macro, so abstract, everything is at the highest level, that we lose sometimes the spiritual dimension that comes from the human or the humane. So I'm curious, I'd love for you to maybe start when we come coming back to the roots of injustice. How do you unpack this idea of the impulse towards imperialism or the imperialist impulse?
Yes, okay. Thank you. You know, I think that the human person is really the anchor of everything, that nothing changes except through the agency of human beings. And no justice or injustice can be perpetrated or achieved except through the agency of the human person. So I think the abstractions that we make about nation, about so-called civilization, this civilization, that, is really hiding the reality of the individual responsibility. And we have to bring it back always to that. Because that's where the source of all evil is, and that is where the source of all goodness is. And that we have to bring it to the person and to the individual and responsibility of the individual person, if we are to expect any significant change or improvement in conditions and around us. So the idea of the imperial impulse for me, as I tried to explain in one article, I think it was by that title, I think, it was a lecture or a series of lectures I gave at Berkeley, and 2010. And it is published in a volume of essays that come out of that series of lectures. And also it's available on my website. People can download and so on. Is that I think the point is that it is the individual person who is responsible for the imperialism and for the humanity of their societies and their cultures. We tend to forget, we tend to bury rather through our arrogance and evasiveness of responsibility that we don't realize that we are the source of it all. There is an expression that I remember Saz Mahmoud used to say, and I don't know if he was quoting someone or he was the author of that expression, which is that human relationships are the supreme value in the universe. That's how he put it. Everything, good and bad, is drawn to that. And more recently, the recent book I published is called Decolonizing Human Rights, in which I was very critical of the so-called international protection of human rights as a total sham. It is really a confidence trick, and it is a new colonial project, nothing to do with human rights in their own essence and value. So for me, therefore, is to uphold human rights, I have to oppose the hypocrisy and the double standards of the way in which human rights are used in public discourse and especially geopolitical discourse as a pretext for invading and dominating on the so-called civilizing mission of West European and North American societies to believe that they are the savers of humanity, although they are in fact the exact opposite of it. So the point there for me is therefore is how to bring responsibility to the individual person. Of course, starting with myself, and that's also one of the values that Saz Mahmoud emphasized, that if we don't live our values, we cannot really have them, have any credibility in trying to advocate or present them to anybody else. So in my work on so-called decolonizing human rights, I have come to the idea that it is only through cultural transformation and political mobilization that we can hope to change attitudes and behavior in the interest of human rights globally in every society and on a larger scale. So the point is that it has to be within the individual experience and that it has to be something that we do before we ask anybody else to do. Therefore, now that I am so critical and disillusioned by the so-called international community, there is no international community. It is not a community, and it is not international. It is really the same colonial powers assuming leadership of global politics and human relationships and economies in order to continue their domination and exploitation. The so-called imperial impulse continues in that guise. So therefore, the challenge has to come from within those societies, as well as from others who have to stand up and reject and refuse to accept the neo-colonial impulse and imperial impulse of colonial powers. Therefore, it is for me, the question is really how to bring the challenge to each of us individually. You see, I'm sorry to take too long on this, but that we find that imperialism and capitalism are extremely devious and shrewd, and they know how to cover up and hide. I mean, through sports, through entertainment, through luxury and privilege. They're very seductive in their ways of hiding the real issues and suppressing the truth everywhere. And therefore, that consciousness of, oh my God, is almost for me as if I wake up in the middle of the night and oh my God, how could I not see this? How could I not understand this? Mm. Now that is the challenge for me. Now in my retirement, whatever is left of it, that I have to find ways of making this real. No, not just simply preaching it, but standing for it and living by it in a way that makes it real and possible.
I have two questions that kind of come out of your reflections. The first is almost, why is it so important to not leave human rights to the imperialists in a way? Mm. Why is it so important to defend, given that human rights has been so quote unquote, co-opted by the international community and used as an instrument of power. Why is it so important not to cede the ground on the discussion of human rights? I think that's just one question I have. And another question I have is, I think for in, for example, a highly capitalist world where you have corporations loading, you know, responsibility onto individuals, for example, to reduce their footprint of pollution, for example, or a very overly liberal discussion which emphasizes a lot on the role of the individual and underplaying community ties. How do you understand this idea of individual responsibilities at the core of human rights protection as something we protect between each other without ending up in a place where we're just atoms or atomized people protecting each other as individuals, if that makes sense?
Human rights are just simply too valuable to leave to global powers and to capitalism and other forms of imperialism. And I think actually, I believe that the idea of human rights may have had its origins in human thought through the centuries, but it came to be possible to realize by the end of the Second World War, precisely because of the revulsion and anger and frustration that people felt about the brutality of war and the destructiveness of war with nuclear weapons at hand. And when it became really a matter of life and death for humanity globally, that was the moment of birth of the human rights movement. But because of its moral power, because of its extreme value, the states had to hijack it. And especially the colonial states or the former colonial states. So it is so powerful in motivating and driving people to action that those who worried about the outcome of that action attempted and succeeded actually in hijacking the movement and in dressing it up in the will and the resources of states and nation states. So it's ironic because what I call the paradox of the contradiction and paradox of expecting the state to protect us from the state. Because the state is the primary source of violation of human rights globally, everywhere, including Spain, with all due respect, including every country that you can think of, no exceptions. And yet, the sort of states managed to hide. That's why I said earlier that imperialism and are so shrewd and manipulative, in that they hide the reality of the contradiction in expecting United Nations and international relations among states to protect human rights of individuals everywhere. It cannot happen. It is a contradiction in terms. But therefore, we have to break away from this. And therefore, for me, human rights is the end and the means. And that I think that we have to understand that we use human rights in order to achieve human rights. So I have to have them immediately. And I cannot look to anybody else to protect my human rights unless I am willing to struggle and to stand up for my own rights to begin with. There are many who are disempowered and marginalized and disenfranchised to be able to act effectively. But whatever it is, whoever we are, there is something we can do. If only to keep the fire in our hearts and souls going for justice and for freedom and for what I call, you know, the most fundamental to me is self-determination, the ability to be self-determining human agent. Has to be paramount and to have to be kept alive. There is something I call about myself. I call myself a post-colonial subject, which is ironic that I am so fundamentally anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist, but I am a product of colonialism. I was born in Sudan in 1946. Sudan was an Egyptian-British colony at the time, and continued to be until 1956 when Sudan became independent. So for the first 10 years of my life, Sudan was a colony. But to me, the perpetuation of colonialism goes much deeper than physical occupation. It is domination and exploitation. Wherever that happens, in whatever relationships that may exist, or institutions or resources and so on that are used. So therefore, for me, the challenge is to keep seeing the reality of the fact that colonialism persists. Now we call it neocolonialism. The post-colonial itself is in fact a perpetuation of colonialism. Because the point here is that colonialism, of course, because they come with this notion of civilizing mission, and they persuade the colonized to think that, in fact, we have to depend on the colonial to be able to live a human life and that we deserve and so on. But in fact, they are giving up that life in the very act of submitting to the colonial model of things. I find that, ironically, as I get older, I get more radical and more angry and more impatient with my own ability to present my ideas clearly enough to be persuasive. Therefore, everything I say is about myself as well as everybody else or anybody else. That is, I'm not exempting myself from any of this. But at least to be able to see clearly and to be able to speak honestly and to act with integrity, these are the values that I hope to have acquired in my own early childhood and through my association with Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha. To your point about individual responsibility, in fact, a plug-in maybe, I don't know. The University of Bergen have a seminar which will convene in about 4 weeks from now in Bergen, Norway, celebrating a very long-standing relationship between University of Bergen and University of Khartoum. And I'm giving a speech there or a talk there which looks at the question of the civil war in Sudan. You know, it's ironic that, and it's always like this, that we never realize how vulnerable we are until we are overtaken by the same vulnerability that we fail to see coming. That all along we look at all our neighbors, war in Chad, war in Libya, war in Ethiopia, war in Indonesia, everywhere. And we think that somehow we are exempt. That Sudan is so kind, so nice, people are so pleasant that they can't possibly engage in these atrocities and so on. Yes, now we do. And we do with viciousness and with amazing brutality. So the question for me that I wish to discuss is how to get out of this mindset and to break the pattern of violence and so on. The nation state is the problem. But the nation state is so seductive and manipulative that we never see it as the problem. We tend to think everything else. So, and who is the nation state? It is the elites who control the state, of course. There is no human institution called nation or religion or whatever it is that is autonomous of human agency. It's always the agency of individual persons responsible for the actions and so on. So how to keep that sort of insight of the centrality of self-determination and human agency in action at every level? Look around the world and listen to the news every day or read the news every day. Everywhere it is about the stupidity and the arrogance of thinking that there is something called the nation or the state that we have to protect at every cost and that this is the only way to progress and to civilization. In fact, it is the exact opposite. But it is seductive enough to have co-opted all of our thinking and imagination into thinking that this is the way to go. We have to uphold nationalism. And look at it. I mean, everywhere, Spain, with all due respect, Britain, France, everywhere, the United States, Russia. I mean, even the word immediately evoke images of manipulation, of greed, and of power mongering. And yet we fail to see that, and we think that, oh yes, we are the exception to human experience globally and historically. Nobody is an exception. It's just that we don't see our lack of exceptionalism, as it were. So for me, therefore, the key has to be the individual responsibility of the citizens of the major powers, of the citizens of the so-called developing countries, and to realize that all of this is being covered in layers of deceptive discourse, and we have to throw it open and look, see the real issues. And we'll always find that if an individual person is not willing to stand up to this, nothing will happen. No change has ever been made in human history except through the agency of individual human being. I say that orthodoxy is always started as a heresy. It's always about how, at some point, some individual person was willing to stand up and say no. And that became the orthodoxy of tomorrow, by being hijacked by the powers that be. And therefore, we have to keep uncovering the deceptiveness and the manipulation of nationalism, of religion, of politics, and all these so-called human institutions and values.
Wow, there's so much richness, so many threads that we can go down. I'm curious then, okay, we have this situation of intense seductions of many kinds from elites, whether they be national elites, whether they be corporate elites, whether they be global elites, however you want to frame that. How does an individual go about reckoning, first of all, with the density of seductions? And also, what does it mean then to kind of go back to what you were saying about the transformation comes through cultural transformation, for political mobilization, but almost on the back of that individuals pushing that agency by standing up for human rights, by being, in the best sense, the heretics of justice?
Yes.
I'm curious how you think that through. And also, I think there's something that comes across in your work is also the importance of consensus and how to build kind of collectively, even though we come as individuals, but we need to build this from a position of consensus, in a sense. And I'd love to, something that you're not afraid of is to sit with paradoxes. In fact, you always bring up, and I think Albie Sachs's wonderful definition of human rights is the right to be the same and the right to be different. And a hunch I have is that I think that individuals need to learn to live with those paradoxes and to kind of, to be able to know that you are part of a context and yet think very critically about that context all the time. But I'm curious on advice you might have to people, activists, young activists in particular, activists of all kinds, struggling maybe with their own identity, with understanding who are they in this moment in time, seeing the intensity of global crises, of inequality, of violence, of war, of planetary crisis, intensification of systemic racism, so many different crises. How would you suggest maybe an individual goes about that process of grounding themselves, challenging some of the seductions, and situating themselves in how they can navigate what it means to act as towards justice?
Yes, okay. I think the key has to be consciousness and thoughtfulness, because whatever it is, it's going on as we speak. It is not something that comes openly and says, here I am to seduce you into selling your neighbor and destroying your environment and killing your human fellow human beings in the name of nationalism or cultural identity or this and that. So therefore, it is constant, but also that means that each one of us is in fact a witness of this. That we, if we don't see it or anywhere we don't see it, it is sort of almost like, if excuse my metaphor, if I'm wearing glasses and they are dark or they are dirty, or so I have to clean them, take them out and clean them and put them back to see. But it doesn't have to be glasses. I can see without glasses, because it is here, not here. It is in the minds and mind and heart, not in the eyes physically. So to see how possibilities of transformation. Without that imaginary of transformation, we can't do anything. I mean, we are just doomed to defeatism and helplessness. But to be able to to understand and to see and to act accordingly. And wherever we are, whoever we are, there is something that we can do. But one of the tools of imperialism and nationalism and so on is to sort of seduce us into thinking that we are incapable of action except through collectivities. But collectivities are collectivities of human individual persons. But that is hidden from us, or at least not explicit, but we tend to fail to see it happening also. Therefore, when you say nation state, or you say a religious community, or we say it is always human beings who manipulate the consciousness of other human beings in order to realize their greed and ambition and so on. So it is that ability to see constantly. And you know, it is ironic, but in the recent events and world, I mean, like the question of global warming and environmental disasters that is forthcoming, or the problem with, of course, war and weapons and all that destruction that goes on. It is always ironic to see how good causes are initiated and developed and presented, and they penetrate all sorts of difficulties only to be hijacked at a later stage. So the global warming discourse, as you mentioned earlier on, is really, it is the same problem in a different disguise or a new style and model. And therefore, we have to realize that it is the same struggle. And it is a struggle that is for justice, for human dignity, for individual freedom, and that the state is the quintessential enemy of all of this. That global, international, intergovernmental institutions and organizations are really simply the tool of global imperialism. And that imperialism is not only Western. In fact, Western is just simply the latest manifestation of an ancient global human experience of exploitation and manipulation by elites over everybody else. And that includes, again, socialism. So the point I was beginning to make earlier is that whenever an idea is credible enough and serious enough to challenge the dominance of global sort of the imperial impulse, it's hijacked. Whether it is anti sort of environmental issues or even activities like you know, banning landmines, for example, which is a good example of how a global movement caught the imagination of so many persons that they were able to achieve. But then they were hijacked into, it is not addressing our domestic politics in those terms. It's going running on to Canada to draft a treaty and call it elimination of global of mines. And then the question becomes ratification and reservations against obligations and questions of budget. So almost like it eats itself, you know, like a fire eating itself. It eats itself into these distractions. But all of these are tactics of hijacking. And therefore, to be able to see this, and every single person on the planet is able to see if they just take a moment to think about what is really going on. And therefore, it is for me, I'm not in the least pessimistic. In fact, I call myself a pragmatic optimist, that I believe there is no limit, absolutely no limit to what human beings can do. But we have to go to be pragmatic about it, to be one step at a time, to plan and to think and to act accordingly.
What is, I'm curious, I mean, I guess you can call them tactics of hijacking, but I'm curious on building on this pragmatic optimism. What do you think are pragmatic tactics that, as an activist, but also as a scholar, that you know, in these years, you feel more drawn to or feel more inspired by or more hopeful about? I see a few in your work that I think are very interesting. So, for example, one thing that I really appreciate about your academic work, and feel free to correct me if you think I've gotten this totally wrong, is that you criticize this idea of academia kind of trying to accumulate knowledge or prove something, and then post facto, almost once it's finished, to go out and confirm it. And there's this method that you use of persuasion, of consensus building, where through the process of research itself, you try and build the outcomes that you're looking towards. You don't wait for to be finished to try and do something. You do it through the process itself, this idea of human rights as the means and the end. This, and also I think a very important one, is the defense of pluralism and diversity and of cross-cultural conversation. I think this is, as a tactic, is, it sounds very obvious, but I think it's deeply, deeply radical and anti-hegemonic. But those are just some that I'm very drawn to in your work. But I'm curious, against the tactics of hijacking, what could be the tactics of maybe of authenticity, however we might want to call them, tactics that you think advance justice and tap into this pragmatic optimism?
Yes. I think that for me, what I call diffusion of power, to understand that power is not necessarily in the hands of the so-called powerful. It's in fact equally in the hands of the so-called powerless, if only they could see their power, if they only could understand the dynamic and the potential of the power we already have. And for me, the reason I see that there is absolutely no limit to human imagination and human agency and power of transformative power is in global communication, universal communication, that the ability to, which now we call it social media, but that too has been hijacked. You see, that is the thing that every time we invent something that is a tool to our empowering ourselves and communicating and sharing our power with others, it gets hijacked. And the hijacking is in itself a testament to its potential, because it is so serious and challenging and dangerous to the powerful and to the privileged and to the capitalist, imperialist elements in our societies. That's why they are hijacked. And they are hijacked, the term hijack is to use to, in order to hide the fact that they are being taken over. And to pretend that, oh yes, we have to. You know, about human rights, there's something I call human rights dependency, which is the idea that we have to publicize, document and publicize human rights violations, go to Geneva, go to New York, and publish in this journal and that newspaper and so on, in order to publicize the reality of human rights violations. But nothing is said about what it takes to dismantle that power. And therefore, that's why the hijacking can happen, is because power is hidden. Or the power of the privileged few who manipulate power hide what they're doing in the very language that we use to express our aspirations and our dreams and visions. So to be able to see through the fog of media and to understand the fundamental power that we already have and we are squandering over petty issues that preoccupy ourselves and are being rendered more seductive for us to distract us from what we do and what we have to do. But we already have it. It's there. I mean, so the question of the environment, the question of countering the transnational corporations and major powers and how they manipulate our crisis in order to perpetuate their power. In other words, I think if and by the way, with all due respect, without in any way undermining what you do, what you do now is exactly what needs to be done. Just this act, the act that you approach me to think that how about this conversation and we can, that's all the source of power that we need to communicate these ideas. And to inspire each other in their realization. That is all it takes. Because the powerful cannot really coerce us physically into doing anything. But they can of course, they can coerce a few, but they cannot really achieve the degree of manipulation that they require without hijacking and dressing up their power grab and power mongering in language and terms and processes like this conversation and the way it goes through the internet to reach everybody anywhere in the world. These are the insights that we need to have, that we already have what we need, that we are already part of the way. This is not, I mean, the previous generation, our generation or mine, of course, is 2-3 generations back, but your generation and the next generation, every generation is a step forward, but we don't see the achievements that we make. In fact, to instill despondency and despair in our ability to change, we are sort of seduced into thinking that no, nothing makes any difference. There is no change happening. There is change, and we can just make it faster and sooner and more radical and global by deploying the maximum force and power of our tools. Conversation, language, of course, arts. It is all within the grasp of individuals to make the difference that they need to make.
Thank you so much, Abdullahi. And I have a few more questions I'd like to ask you before you wrap up. So much of your wonderful work is focused, of course, on Sharia and on thinking through liberatory possibilities for Sharia, and really also challenging a lot of the, I guess, going back to your language, right, the seductions or the way in which manipulations are used to hide behind religion. So I'd like to open up this conversation for you to talk a little bit about some of the questions that remain with you now on Sharia, looking back at your work over the last decades. What are some of the maybe achievements also? I know that a lot of the work you've done has been in translation in many languages and has really been behind a lot of projects of intense and inspiring reformation and rethinking. But I'm curious on you looking back and thinking, what have been some of the achievements of this work to think through liberatory possibilities of Sharia? And where do you see the future of Sharia in the next decades?
Yeah. Of course, I mean that Sharia is a specific problem for Muslims, but it has equivalent or corresponding values and institutions in other cultures too. It's organized religion. And how organized religion will use whatever discourse is most effective in sort of seducing people into thinking that we already have what we need. In fact, we don't. So when I grew up, when I was a child and growing up and going to school and university, and the reason that I came to join Taha's movement is the injustice of sex discrimination and racial discrimination, religious discrimination, and the injustice of it all, and how I have to do whatever it takes to transform that. But that does not happen from without. It has to happen from within. So for me, the earliest work I was doing about human rights is what I call internal discourse and cross-cultural dialogue. So the tool of consensus building through internal discourse and cross-cultural dialogue, by that I mean we have to expand the scope of our consensus and our shared vision, expand and deepen. So it has to be powerful enough and to inspire change, to inspire transformation in individual persons and their attitudes to life and so on. Men, how they treat women in so-called religious communities, people, how do they treat so-called unbelievers, and so on. So it is constantly working at that level of consensus building through shared visions and through the golden rule, as we were saying earlier on. But therefore, for me as a Muslim, I realized that I cannot really change Muslims' attitudes about anything without addressing their fundamental misconceptions of what Sharia is about and why it is the way that it is. The point for me, at which I came through working with Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha's ideas, is that any understanding of Sharia is human. It is never divine, because it is the agency and experience and context of individual persons who interpret and render these maxims and sort of doctrines and so on as if they are divine. But in fact, they are just human devices to reflect the nature of existing power relations. And therefore, to speak of Sharia is not to speak about what is wrong with Islam. It's also to speak about, it is that, but it's also to speak about what is right about Islam. That there is a point that I often make, which is I say that Islam is a radically democratic religion. It is Muslims who are the problem, not Islam in the abstract. By that, I mean that it is Muslims who submit, who surrender their agency and their vision and their conviction, the religious conviction, to the powers that be, to be presented. Remember, you mentioned earlier on, I think when you said that, I used to, my teachers used to call me Socrates, Socrates in Arabic, in intermediate school. I remember the teacher who invented the term was the teacher of Islamic studies, because I was constantly raising very embarrassing questions about how this, and so on. So he said, he would say, shut up, you just like Socrates. Implying, of course, that I could also be killed eventually if I don't look out for this. But the point is that to say that it is very deep and it's very early. It goes to our education. We have to transform our education. And when I say transform, I don't mean wait for the state to transform it for us, because that, in fact, is defeating the purpose. But I'm saying that, you know, like every community or every person with other persons in collective political will and cultural will and vision, transform the education of their own children, which requires transforming of their own self-understanding and education and so on. So Sharia is human. There is nothing divine about it. We Muslims believe that the sources are divine, but the sources they have no possibility of penetrating into human consciousness through the agency of human being. It has to be the language. It has to be the communication strategies, instructive strategies, in order to reach people's consciousness and ability to act. So understanding that, I think, is key to opening the door. Now, for me, 40 years later, I am thinking, okay, what is it that I missed in this long quest for theoretical understanding of Sharia in a way that is transformative? What is missing is the ability to communicate that, and how to communicate. And that's where, honestly and candidly, that's why I was so eager to accept your invitation, because this setting, this conversation, I know is reaching thousands of people in all sorts of cultures and situations and levels of consciousness. Reaching all these people and opening the door for conversation with all of them, and for them among themselves as well, that is the way. So the tools of change are in our hands, except that every time that we realize the value, it is hijacked from us. And the irony is that it is hijacked by hijacking our will, or hijacking our imagination. Nobody can take away my vision except through my acquiescence, at least. And therefore, refusing to acquiesce to the hijacking of values and institutions and power is the way to stand up and to keep going forward.
I want to ask you two final questions. The first one is, I'd love to invite you, if you feel comfortable, sharing a little bit about spirituality and your own spiritual practice, if that's something you feel comfortable with. I think that, yes, as you said from the beginning, this starts with individuals. This starts with us.
Yes.
And I remember hearing you speak about Ustad Mahmoud Taher and this idea of his teachings on power as something that you renounce, right? That spirituality is the renunciation of power in a way. I'm curious on what spirituality means for you in the day-to-day, how it informs your political practice, and yeah, whatever you feel comfortable sharing about how you live your spirituality.
I think with the spirituality and religious experience and practice, it's very much contextual, and often it is hidden in the same type of or involved in the same time of power struggle that we see in the political field, in the economic field, and elsewhere. So for me, as a Muslim, raised as a Muslim, and coming to understand Islam in a radically different manner through the work of Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, is the way that enables me to reconcile my global human impulse to be humane, to be compassionate, to be accepting of the other on their own terms. That is absolutely crucial, that there is no acceptance of the other except on their own terms. But what is going on all the time, most of the time, is that we accept them on our terms, that they are human to the extent that they are like us, that they are equal to the extent that they are like people like us who are equal. And so on. So it is that ability to accept. You mentioned Al-Bisak's expression about human rights and the right to be the same and the right to be different, because it is the right to be the same on that other person's terms, not on my terms. But if I insist that you can be equal to me only if you are like me or you are one of us, then we defeat the purpose, and so on. So it is that ability to share and to understand and to transcend our narrow conceptions of self and the other. I mentioned earlier the term global citizenship. I think that is the only way forward. There is no possibility of humanity really surviving, let alone thriving, except through renouncing narrow-minded sort of egoistic nationalism and sexism and our other form of accumulation and consolidation of power. What I called early on, the global sort of the sharing of power, diffusion of power, to understand that whatever it is that drives our action can drive other people to action too. It's our failure to communicate more than the failure of others to be inspired by what they are saying. And we have the tools for that. And the tools are within our grasp, but we allow them to be hijacked, as I said, by not realizing the full potential of their power. And therefore, for me, the spirituality is a tool of self-gratification and coming to peace within myself, but also to communicating effectively with others. And the term spirituality is attractive over religion, because religion is a power relations issue. It's a question of accumulation of power, whereas spirituality is the diffusion of power. And to understand, yeah, there is a spirituality in every religion, but they are not synonymous. And therefore, to be able as a Muslim to accept every other religious belief or lack of religious belief as equally valid and justified and empowering, that takes more than my conviction as a believer. I also speak about belief being a choice, that I cannot believe unless I am equally able to disbelieve. The very idea of belief immediately raises the question of choice in the belief. If I don't have that choice, I cannot have belief really to speak of. And therefore, upholding the fundamental need for disbelief is a way of securing my need for belief, that I cannot believe in my own articles of faith or belief or practices unless I am equally committed to upholding other people's choice in all of that, or lack of choice, or destroying and blocking the lack of choice in their experiences. The idea is to turn the question of power and the question of human relationship on its head, to refuse to acknowledge the powerful, despite the temptation to do so or seduction to do so, and to realize that it is I am as powerful with you and the other individual person everywhere, more than the powerful would like us to believe that they are powerful beyond our challenge.
Thank you so much. This brings me to my final question before we ask you for a recommendation. You know, this podcast is called The Fire These Times, after the quote from James Baldwin. Mm. And we started this conversation, you spoke about the fire in your belly that was there from the beginning. And we have listeners listening from many, many different countries, from dozens of countries, people with many different mother languages, mother tongues, all, I think, bound together by a commitment to act upon the fire in our bellies in these times of intense inequality and injustice. And so my invitation is to offer you, if you have any message you want to share with everyone, the microphone is yours.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think an idea that comes to mind is the idea that, for me, the only category that there is the human. Everything else is a product of experience and context. And what is universal is humanity. And therefore, to address that humanity and to reach for that humanity is the only way to bring all visions together into a shared future of sustainability and justice and prosperity and security for everyone. Therefore, language is a problem in that it has been a tool of imperialism, and it is still a tool of division and sectarianism and violence in many societies. Again, to think of very, you know, the Basque in Spain, or the idea that language can always be a problem. But at the same time, ironically, it is also very empowering too. If we take a correct attitude about the role of language in our discourses, that's, in other words, English has become, although it came to that position through imperialism, but it is no longer an imperial language in the sense that it has been co-opted and hijacked, you might say, by so many societies and so many activists and freedom fighters in their own struggles, that it is no longer sort of the privy of the imperial. But we have to realize too that we have to transcend the limitation of language in order to achieve true global communication and conversation. The dominant languages often come to their positions through imperial practices. Arabic is the dominant language in the region of North Africa, West Africa, and Middle East, and so on, through imperialism, Islamic, so-called Islamic imperialism, that came to dominate and to impose this language on everybody else. But now that people have come to consciousness that realized the full potential of their ability to organize and to hijack or to co-opt the language itself into their own struggles. We can't do without it, but we don't have to be limited by it in a way that denies us the ability to see beyond the immediate context and so on. So I think that to how to keep using languages that have come to prevail through imperial practices in anti-imperial struggles in order to reach out and so on. You mentioned about an example of someone I would, of course, the someone would be Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, but the limitation is that his work was in Arabic, and as such, it's inaccessible to the vast majority of humanity who do not read and study or know this language. But at the same time, there are some who have mastered the Arabic language who can't translate into other languages. But it is more than simply translation in the sense of technical conveyance of meaning into conveyance of value. So it is how to communicate the value of a shared language despite the lack of a shared language, by creating possibilities of vision and understanding and so on. My struggle, as I mentioned to you before we started this conversation, is that the only human being that I find is really worth citing as an example, Al-Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha. The only limitation is that his work is in Arabic. But the possibilities is that also there is always translation that can open the door for many possibilities. I translated Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha's main book. It's called The Second Message of Islam, Ar-Rithala Thaniya Min Al-Islam. And it was a charge that Ustaz Mahmoud himself gave to me hand in hand. He said, Abdullahi, translate this book. And that was around 1979 or 80. And I took it from his hand. I translated the same copy, actually, that he gave me to translate. And that book has been published in English, but then from there into other languages too. Now there are more than 20 doctoral dissertations that are done on Ustaz Mahmoud's work and life and experience. And all of this sort of groundswell of compassion and interest and understanding is growing rather than diminishing. And it's growing despite the execution of the author. And here I say that you can't kill an idea by killing its author. If anything, human history shows that killing the author is in fact a proclamation of the idea rather than its diminishing influence and extinction. So there are so many ideas. I think I'm sure that your audience and people who listen and share in your conversations already have all of this. I mean, I'm only touching on points here and there to remind us of the shared ground that we have.
Thank you so much, Abdullahi, for illuminating that shared ground and watering it today. We will add links to a website which contains, primarily in Arabic, the work of Ustad Mahmoud Taha in the bottom of the podcast, and also links to your work. But we want to thank you on behalf of the Fight These Times for joining us today and for sharing all your insights and life work.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Thank you.